The Monday Night Wars started in 1995, igniting wrestling fans' obsession with TV ratings. Many fans today say TV ratings don't matter, but if you've ever listened to chart music, read a bestseller, or cared about some sporting attendance, you can't say ratings don't matter. The Monday Night Wars saw a variety of head bookers and head of creatives, each of who lived and died professionally by the ratings they brought in. Unbooking the Territory looks at the episodes that scored highest and lowest for each creative period to answer the question, do ratings equal quality? On this episode of Unbooking the Territory, we'll be looking at the short period at the start of the Monday Night Wars when Vince McMahon didn't have a head booker or head of creative and was in sole charge of the creative of the show himself.
Let me tell you a personal story about Vince McMahon.
Come on, Vince. Come on down. It'll be fun.
I own the WWF, and you will treat me with respect.
And I am sick of our chairman. He mocks God. He mocks God.
Vince, you are relieved of your duties.
So on this sort of journey through the ups and downs of the TV ratings of the Monday Night Wars with me is a man who it's an absolute pleasure to watch wrestling with, whether in person or remotely, Dan Griffin.
That's dubious, but very nice introduction for the first episode. Thanks for letting me in on the ground floor on this little idea. Very happy to be in. It was nearly a perfect start in the talk about watching wrestling with me because I was just swigging a beer. Well, true to life.
True to form, isn't it? I remember one time we went to the True Grit Rumble and you went to the bar and came back with six Budweisers and we thought, Dan's got us a round in and Addie Elliott was for himself.
I knew you'd bring that up, you fucker. Wait, hang on, this isn't PG, is it?
No, don't worry about that. In a couple of episodes' time, we'll get to a tag team called PG-13, but that's probably the only rating we'll have on the show.
You're anticipating a lot of viewers, then, mate.
Well, who knows? Who knows? So a lot of podcasts, when people introduce each other, they sort of ask about how people got into wrestling, that kind of thing. And it feels like your first week at uni when everyone's going, what A-levels did you do? What subjects did you? what subjects did you take? What grades did you get? All that sort of stuff. And it just feels like that forced conversation. So we sort of came up with an idea which will sort of explain how we feel about wrestling, but won't be the generic, you know, first match you saw, that kind of thing. But it'll give you a bit of a context of how we see wrestling and how we're going to sort of rate these shows. And we do appreciate that wrestling's a buffet rather than just one particular thing that people might like. So everyone takes something different. And what we'd be able to do, especially if we get more people on the show as the weeks go by, we can create these little radars like they have on FIFA so you can compare two people to each other, sort of overlay them so we can get some graphics on the socials to show you that. So we came up with five categories that sort of explain.
After a little bit of debate.
After a little bit of debate.
It was surprisingly, it wasn't hard between us to narrow it down. I think we sort of hashed it out pretty quickly. But just the first sort of thought about it, when you're trying to narrow wrestling down to just five elements, it was actually quite hard, like at first, just to think what they are. Because obviously you've got the in-ring product, which I think was both of our first thoughts there. But then narrowing the rest down was quite... Sorry to interrupt you first, about 2 minutes into the first episode, but I just wanted to drop it in there. We didn't just pull this out of our arses.
It's a collaboration. It took us literally minutes to get to the bottom of it. So
Minutes of hard graft.
Minutes of hard graft, which is the most you'll get out of us on a good day. So I feel that's important. But no, it is true. And then it even gets down to sort of how you define in-ring, because you get people, the classic example is people in AEW, like the Young Bucks or whatever, they're doing 50,000 flips, all this sort of thing. They're having five people on the outside of the ring catching them. You know, and it's very sort of appealing to the eye, and there's a hell of a lot of work and technique that goes into it, but there's not that selling element. And you can compare that to, you know, a Rock and Roll Express match from the early 80s where Robert Gibson spending most of the match just selling his arse off. It's a completely different thing. Ricky Morton did do the selling. Yes, Robert Gibson was hot tag. Yeah. That's a really good tag. It's just as well we're not starting in the 80s, isn't it?
Yeah. I just like the fact I'm already fact-checking you.
Right, it's like a Conservative Party Twitter account, this.
What, fact-checking ourselves?
Yeah, fact-checking ourselves, yeah. But we'll get there. We'll get there in the end. So the five categories we came up with were storyline, the in-ring, and we sort of wanted to balance for in-ring. We're talking about technical ability, but we're also adding selling. We've then got promos. We've then got presentation, and presentation includes sort of the production of the show, the commentary, the vignettes, although I suppose within a vignette you could have a promo, so that would probably fall into the promo side rather than the production side.
There's a degree of crossover, yeah.
There definitely is. And then we've gone for fan response, and that's the crowd reaction, which it'd be amazing to have crowds at wrestling at the moment. So you get quite wistful when you watch some of these old shows. And also how the wrestling makes us feel. So our reaction sort of in that. So those are the sort of five level categories. So we sort of ranked those, giving 5 points to the most important and one to the least. So what have you gone with, Dan?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to mention, well, we haven't actually discussed it. We discussed the topics, but we don't know each other's order. And I had sort of a bit of a go around in my own head as to how I would sort of order them. And I've come up with that the most important to me is the storyline. Because first and foremost, I watch wrestling to be entertained, to be told a story. But then the rest of the elements feed into it. So you can't have one without the other. But I just had to bite the bullet eventually and just say, right, here it is. Stop being a knobhead. Just get something down on paper. So for me, 5 points to storyline. And then I've gone for 4 points in presentation because the production, the commentary, the vignettes, all of that sort of the complements and solidifies what's happening in the ring. You know, without the sort of superfluous stuff, you know, the stuff surrounding the match, there's no reason for the match. So you need that to be there. Otherwise, if you don't have that around it, you just have conveyor belt wrestling. Something that we've both experienced and we've talked about on that 90s wrestling podcast before, and I think I've brought up every time since because it was borderline traumatising.
It's funny you should mention conveyor belt wrestling because at this point in WWF's history that we're looking at, the early start of the Monday Night Wars, they were very much engaged in conveyor belt wrestling. The show that we're going to review today was actually the part of a 14-match card, and it was the last sort of segment that was filmed.
I think at times you can tell. You can really tell. But we'll get to that. So, and I'm actually adjusting my rankings on the fly because I've changed my mind. So it was 5 for storyline, 4 for presentation, and 3 for in-ring. Because, let's be fair, I just love watching wrestling. I watch, you know, without the matches, there's no wrestling, is there? I remember once watching an episode of Impact in the Bischoff Hogan era, where I went back and timed it. I had to watch it twice. I went back and timed it. There was 14 minutes of new wrestling content in 2 hours. And I have never been so bored in all my life watching wrestling apart from that conveyor belt wrestling show that we attended. There was replays of other matches, but it's stuff I'd already seen. Some the week before, full matches from the week before repeated. And it was terrible. So the in-ring, one, there has to be enough of it. And two, it has to be, you know, it has to grip you. And like you said before, that could be, you know, a Young Bucks match doing a million flips or, you know, because I think we're both of the slightly older generation. We're sort of nostalgic for a more slow-paced, methodical approach, shall we say, if we're being nice. So 3 points for in-ring, 2 for me, and then 2 points for promos. Promos can really help. Again, it's sort of, it goes down to 2 because promos, I can take them a little, to be honest, I find myself now fast-forwarding through a lot. If I'm, you know, if I'm not particularly engaged in a product anyway, where I was like, yeah, this is fine, but get to the point. I just want to see the match. You can usually guess what a promo is. I think one example that springs to mind recently was I actually took the time to watch the Darby Allin and Sting promo, where they were both in like an abandoned warehouse. And the production around it, the setting, what they physically did, you know, breaking the windows, looking very aggressive, the looks of both the guys with the face paint and all that was all fantastic. The actual words they spoke, I was, eh? They've taken a long time to say nothing. So the promo itself wasn't good, but it was made to feel better by the way it was presented.
Yeah, that's one of the problems with AEW. They give the people a lot of freedom, but sometimes that freedom gives them enough rope to hang themselves. So that you end up sometimes getting promos that are brilliant because they've got that freedom. But the flip side is sometimes you get promos where they wander off or they're completely off topic or they just fall into the absurd.
And then the other side of that is you get the WWE where everything is so micromanaged and scripted and written for talent in a lot of cases that it just comes across as completely unnatural.
Yeah, there needs to be a happy medium between the two, really.
Yeah, of course there does. So, moving quickly on, the last one for me then is fan response. And I put that last because of the sort of the two factors we explained. One is the crowd reaction in the building, and then the other part of that is how it makes me feel. But only 50% of the topic actually I really care about. I can be sat there enraptured by a match, and it doesn't matter to me if the crowd on screen don't give a shit, which would actually lead nicely onto the first match of this of this Raw. But
I'll let this go before we get there. But yeah,
yeah, foreshadowing, Rob. I'm not a professional. Who am I kidding? But yeah, so that's why I put it last, because the crowd responds in the arena, while it's nice and it does help when you have like that massive pop at certain moments, it doesn't dictate what I enjoy to as much of a degree as the rest of it.
No, that's completely fair. I do understand that. I do. Similar to you, I've gone for storyline as the most important. It's really the storyline that pulls you in. I love that soap opera element to wrestling. If you've got a storyline where you can't wait to see what happens next week, or one of the things that kind of annoys me about the modern product, and one thing that really put in focus, and this is a bit weird, but during the lockdown, I actually went through and rewatched all the classic Doctor Who's, and they were 20-minute shows. And at the end, there was always a hanger, and you were always, I need to find out what's happening next. It's really bingeable, even though it's 50 years old. But the thing about wrestling today is they'll go to a commercial break, and that there isn't anything important happening. It's just, you know, oh, someone's working a rest hold, we're going to go to a commercial break. You can almost tell on Raw when they're going to a break. And
here's the bit we've built in for TV.
Yeah, but the TV should be used as something, as a benefit. You've got that commercial break. You need to make people stay through the adverts. So let's make something exciting. Let's make a reason for them to stay and watch.
Playing sort of devil's advocate on that, though, on that particular issue, I think the idea is that all the action happens ad to ad. So they're trying to tell the audience that you're not going to miss anything in the meantime. It's just a wrestle. All the action's going to happen when you get back.
Yeah.
But that's the downfall of that is it. I'm going to sound like a right knob here, but it breaks any sort of sense of immersion. It's not like you'd be watching a football game and they just start playing out from the back. And, you know, like, for example, I'm a Liverpool fan, like Liverpool do, dick about at the back for 2 minutes and say, oh, we're just going for an ad break because they're kicking the ball about. They're not due to attack for another 3 minutes, so you won't miss anything. Go get yourself a drink. So for devil's advocate, I think that's the logic behind it, but the logic is flawed.
I agree. Anyway, moving on to my taste. I've gone for promo next, and it sort of fits in with storyline. And it's the sort of thing that sort of draws you in, that makes you want to watch the upcoming matches. I think sometimes the anticipation of the match is almost better than the match. Mm. And sometimes you've had these great sort of overarching storylines and promos sort of between two people or two factions or whatever. And the end of the whole story might be disappointing. The final match might not live up to things. And a lot of people sort of pin their opinion of that feud on the final match. But to me, it's sort of the journey getting there, and the promos are a massive part of that. So that's why I've put that up so highly. And again, sort of in that regard, I've put presentation. So, you know, the production, the commentary, the vignettes as the third place.
So just to go back to your 4 points there, the promos. It's more about the pipe bomb and not about Punk eventually losing his title to The Rock.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I understand that. I do. I understand that.
You know, I mean, for that analogy, it was a great match, CM Punk versus John Cena at Money in the Bank. So you get that. And one thing to stress with this list is that wrestling is perfect when all cylinders are firing.
You know, absolutely, so, yeah.
You know, even if we might put something fifth on this list, it doesn't mean that we don't like it or respect it. It's just that's kind of the least important out of the five, but ideally we want to see all five up there. So second last, I've gone for fan response, and I think this is probably because A, of the sort of conveyor belt wrestling we've watched recently, and, you know, the wrestling in the pandemic where we see that there aren't crowds, so there haven't been, and it can feel very sterile. You know, the crowd definitely adds to it. It's that sort of, you know, 12th man analogy from football. You know, it really makes a difference.
We've seen the difference in, within one day in Trafalgar Warehouse at those old Southside doubleheaders, where the afternoon crowd would be dead as anything, but get a few beers in him, then for the evening show, rowdy is out, especially with a few more people in.
Yeah, no, and it does make a big difference. It really does. You know, it makes a big difference to that sort of life experience of going to wrestling, but it makes a big difference to how it comes across on TV.
Mm.
And I've put last, I've put the wrestling. You know, there's some wrestling that's absolutely amazing. You can have great wrestling matches. But the problem is sometimes you get matches that are technically brilliant, but if they don't have the storyline and they don't have promos and the people don't have charisma and there hasn't been production behind it and nobody's really caring, then it doesn't really matter that much. And that's kind of why I've put wrestling last. The other thing I'd say about the wrestling is sometimes you can have a match where not much happens, but it advances the storyline. So if you had a match where someone instantly hits the finisher, you know, a squash match or whatever, that can make that wrestler look a lot better than if they'd had a 10-minute classic that, you know, was 50-50. You know, so it's not always the actual total skill that matters that much, which is, you know, why I've put it in last place.
Yeah, that's absolutely fair enough. A couple of things sprung to mind there where you said you can have a great match where nothing much happens, but it either advances a storyline or maybe ends it or anything like that. And we've obviously recently, within the last few months, watched WrestleMania 7, which had the Jake Roberts, Rick Martel blindfold match. Not a lot happened there at all. But and with the advent of HD, you can see the eye holes in the mask, in the hoods. But it was entertaining as hell. Yeah. You sat there and you're absolutely loving it because it's built to this moment. There's a slapstick comedy element to it, but they made it work. And then sort of more recently, something that's actually really got my goat was when Cody wrestled Peter Avalon in AEW. That ended up being a perfectly fine match. Cody got the win against a lower down the card guy. Fair enough. But my problem was they had a distraction by Jade Cargill. To me, just, you know, the armchair booker doesn't never worked in wrestling, so whatever. But to me, the distraction should have cost him the match. Give them an issue. Give them more of an issue. You know, Cody and Shaq, and Cody and Jade. Jade causes the distraction. Cody loses the match. He's incensed. He's full of rage. He's wanting to rip Shaq, you know, rip Shaq's head off for setting this up. Instead, you get a near fall, a two-segment match. Cody must pose.
I completely agree. And I know Peter Avalon's pretty low down the card, but it makes him look completely incompetent. And yes, that's never a good place to put your talent. You know, it also made it look that, you know, anything Jade Cargill's going to do isn't going to sort of affect the match or whatever, you know. So
I try, despite what it may come across, I try not to be snarky watching wrestling now, because I did enough of that in my 20s. I did a lot of it. But certain things just really rankle you. And that was one of them. It was stuck in my mind for long enough, because that was weeks ago at the time of recording, even longer by the time this finally comes out. So, yeah, I fully get what you mean. I've tried to get back on point having the in-ring last, because there's no matches without the rest of it, at least nothing that will make any form of narrative sense. I want to draw people in to watch another week of TV.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And back to your point of bringing it back to those five categories, we'll get those FIFA type radars up on the socials, and the social for the podcast is
Rob will. Rob's the workhorse in this. I just turn up and talk shit.
I don't know. I might have to delegate. I think that's one of the things that I do need to work on. So I'm a professional development delegating some of these tasks. Anyway, let's change tack completely. What are you drinking, Dan?
Beer. Funnily enough.
You're going to give it more of an introduction than...
Yeah, go on then. I'm actually drinking something that that I found in one of my regular perusals of Trembling Madness's new beers online. I'm drinking a Brass Castle Trinitario Chocolate Stout. Shout out to Brass Castle. Sam, who's the head brewer over there, I work with his girlfriend, Keisha. Very fine people, and Sam makes bloody good beer. Cheap plug. Yeah, it's made with Trinidad. I was reading the blurb, and it's actually made with Trinidadian cocoa that's usually reserved for some of the finest chocolates made in the world. And you can really tell that it's bloody lovely, and it'll be going on my Untappd shortly. What are you on?
I am drinking a Daya Stout. It's called All Right Mate. It's a dark, rich, and rosy stout with maple syrup and pecans for a nutty kick. So
I don't fancy a nutty kick. I got one of those earlier when I was playing with my niece.
Sounds like a Shinsuke Nakamura match, doesn't it?
God, when him and AJ went through the cock knocker stage. Yeah. I forgot to mention as well, this is actually a 4-pint growler of hand pulled.
When you showed me that picture of your 4-pint growler, I thought it was antifreeze for your windscreen.
Too good for windscreen, this mate. It's not Carly. One last thing, sorry. Trembling Madness is available for delivery nationwide. Cheap plug for them as well, because they're very good people.
I got my beer from the Triangle in Shipley. I think you just have to turn up and see if they're open. So that's probably the juice at the moment. I don't have anything to deliver at all. But
what did you drink watching the show?
Well, that's interesting, Dan, because you're just going into the next segment where the listeners at home can be Carmella and sit back and relax. And we'll be the virtual Reginald in the beer sommelier section, where we recommend a beer that you should drink while you're watching this episode of Monday Night Raw.
It's almost like we thought about this, and it's almost like I read and remembered the running order.
almost. What did I drink while I was? It's probably Coke that I drank while I was watching the show. But in terms of,
I think a lot of the wrestlers might have had a bit of Coke during the show as well.
I think they probably would. So go on, Dan. What would you recommend?
Well, funnily enough, I actually watched this show drinking a black IPA by Siren and Elusive. It was a collaboration. It's called Zombies Ate My Neighbours. And just by pure coincidence, because I've never had it before, I watched this show, it actually summed it up perfectly. One half bad. Above average. Not by much. It's a black IPA, so it was... nothing massively stood out, but it's definitely not the worst thing I've drank. Like about a two, probably if you're on Untappd, probably a 2.75. Steady away.
I think 2.75 is a decent grade for Untappd. I know I tend to grade lower than most people, but
because I take 2.5 as bang average.
Yeah, but average is good because there are some awful beers out there.
Only if you're not as selective as I am.
I would recommend a beer that I've actually given 2.5 to on Untappd, and that's Magic Rocks. Bearded Lady Dessert Barrel Aged Bourbon Edition. It's a 10.5% Imperial Stout. Some stouts kind of mask how alcoholic they are. This doesn't. You're drinking something close to wine. Yeah, and you're going to need it to get through this episode of Raw. So a kind of average beer from an above average brewery. Magic Rock's one of my preferred breweries, but this
was going to say you're underselling it there, man.
I can't wait till lockdown's over and can go back to the tap. But pride of Huddersfield.
They've not got much to be proud about at the minute.
Yeah, no, they don't. They don't, unfortunately. So the next section of the show, we're going to go to Beth's Beer of the Week.
And Beth's Beer of the Week is Brew York's Time Travelling Taxi.
Well, there was Beth giving the Beer of the Week and Brew York Time Travelling Taxi. Have you had that one, Dan?
I don't believe I have. It's one of the very few Brew York beers I'm yet to try. So it's one of those where I keep seeing it and it's like, I know it's on my list, but I fancy going for this instead. You know? I always get drawn to like Northern Monk or Brass Castle or whatever, and somehow Time Travelling Taxi just hasn't hit my fridge yet, but... No doubt in the very near future. Probably, in fact, it'll have to be now before the next time we record.
I'm convinced I've got a can of it sat at the back of my beer cupboard where I've got quite a big stock of beer to get through. It's funny, though, because having checked Untappd, it doesn't look like Beth's actually rated that one. So I think she's Brew Yorking behind our backs. But,
or she had it at the end of a session and forgot.
That is quite likely. That is quite likely. But there you go. So that's the recommendation. So today we're going to be covering Vince McMahon. So obviously, what more can really be said about Vince McMahon? He became the chairman of the World Wrestling Federation in the early 80s, taking over from his father, actually buying him out, went round systematically trying to shut down all the regional promotions. It's fair to say he'd always had sort of an active role in creative while he'd been in WWF and the role as chairman. In 1993, he started Monday Night Raw to try and give it a more intimate feel. But by the time we're on to 1995, he's tried to move to bigger stadiums. And just at the start of the Monday Night Wars, he had an idea that he was going to try and be a little bit more professional. He was going to try and bring in a head of creative and try and do some more executive functions. And I suppose there's a debate to how well he's actually done that and if he's ever really taken his eye off creative. But certainly for the first couple of episodes of Rory was in charge of creative. Have any thoughts about Vince McMahon, Dan?
How do I say this without getting sued? Well, no, the man's a genius. Obviously, I think the problem is he's sort of perceived successes and failings are all very public knowledge, or what people think are common knowledge, and how much is distorted, how much is, you know, embellished. Vince obviously has been and still is the driving force behind WWE, but he's never done it alone. He's never sort of relinquished that final say. It's hard to know what to think of him because he's a genius. He's also responsible for a lot of shit. Because even when you've got heads of creative in WWE, everything goes through Vince. As far as I'm aware, this is the sort of rumor and innuendo of the whole thing. Does everything go through Vince, or does Vince micromanage segments that then gets picked up by the dirt sheets, or somebody leaks it because they're not happy? And what is the actual proportion of stuff that he's rewriting on the fly and things like that? It's a difficult one.
And it is a good point. And hopefully it's something that we'll be able to shed some light on as we go through this series and look at other writers, look at the likes of Pritchard and Cornette and Russo and Kresge, etc., that are going to be coming up.
The reason I sort of went with that tack straight off is it hit me late last night. You know, obviously, we've done everything and getting ready to record this. I just suddenly thought every creative head, to some degree, is going to have for WWE, that is going to have an asterisk next to the name saying how much of it went through Vince, but we're going to have to take it as read that it was obviously it was all on their watch.
I think to a certain extent, the job of the head writer is to increase the ratings. And even if you've got a Vince McMahon factor in there, the writer's still going to be responsible for what's happening on the show. So I don't know if it's fair to say there's an asterisk. I mean, the other thing I'd kind of say is, as we go through here, we'll be able to see if there is a common pattern or if there were certain stages that are markedly different. I think that may well give us some insight into how much of a role he had. But it's all to come. It's all for the future. And, you know, when we start looking at the WCW side of the argument, there's a lot of times when Bischoff would have had his finger in the pie sort of thing, even when sort of Kevin Sullivan's notionally in charge of booking. So,
and how much goes through Hogan?
Well, exactly. And that was completely different in WCW, because obviously they've got creative control later on. There's standards and practices telling them what to do, what they can and can't do. So I guess to a certain extent, everyone's got the challenges to deal with.
Absolutely.
So just to give a bit of context as to where we sit with the ratings, normally we'll look to do an episode for the highest rated, an episode for the lowest rated. But as we're starting at the Monday Night Wars and Vince was only in charge for two, it kind of just made more sense to do his last episode in charge. So Raw had started in 1993, 1st of November, and got a rating of 2.5. It had gone up on the 24th of April, 95, to a high of 3.9. The first episode of Raw during the Monday Night Wars got a 2.5, and this episode that we're doing today, the 21st of September, 1995, got a 2.7. It was actually broadcast on a Thursday, so it didn't go head-to-head with Nitro, and that may explain a slight bump in the ratings. Got an average of 2.6, and that compares to Bill Watts, who's going to come and take over as head of creative next week, and he got an average of 2.4, but he was only there for four episodes. So very low numbers, very difficult to draw anything from that, but just gives you a little bit of context that we're certainly nowhere near the heights that Monday Night Raw had got up to previously.
No, we are not.
And we may be able to speculate just looking at those numbers. We don't know if things are going to get better in the short term, but we can find out. That's all going to be part of the joy of things to come. So, as we said before, this was the last part of a 14-match card. It was filmed at Canton, Ohio, in the Memorial Civic Center. There was approximately 1,600 people. Although when they say 1,600 people, I'm assuming that's 1,600 people when they started filming. I'm not particularly sure. By the time this episode of Monday Night Raw rolled down around, there was exactly 1,600. And this was the go-home show for In Your House 3. So obviously they're sort of building towards that pay-per-view. So we start the show with a video package. It shows Dean Douglas jumping off the top rope to attack Razor Ramon while he's pinning the British Bulldog. And then we see another segment later on where the 1-2-3 kid does the exact opposite. So while the Bulldog's pinning Razor, the kid jumps. But obviously the Bulldog's a bit savvier and he moves out of the way. So the 1-2-3 kid lands on Razor. obviously this leads to a bit of a fallout. We end up with them shouting at each other, 1-2-3 kids saying to Razor, "You treat me like a little kid," and challenge him to a match next week. And this is quite interesting because it's sort of, especially saying "treat me like a little kid," this is sort of sowing seeds for the crybaby match that's going to be coming up at In Your House 6. So there's going to be a fair old build to that. But did you have any thoughts about this segment, Dan?
Well, for one, I was actually really happy with the recap because I didn't watch the Raw before, so it was quite nice to know what was going on. leading into it, the one thing I noticed was that it hit every major story point that you needed and didn't outstay its welcome on that recap. But it was clear, it was concise, and I think it had to be because this show had a runtime. It'd have occupied an hour slot, but the actual runtime of the show was about 44 minutes, give or take. So it needed to be, and it was actually. There's a lot of recency bias here because obviously we live in the age of 3 hour Raws, 2 hour Smackdowns, 2 hours of Dynamite, 2 hours of Impact, anywhere up to 2 hours of AEW Dark. There's a lot of time to fill. So to have that quick recap saying this happened, we're going to have the intro and then we're going to have the first match that links into what you just saw. It was ideal for me. And again, this is a lot of recency bias, but it felt like NWA Power captured the same thing. Everything's short, sharp, to the point because we've only got this short block of time. So that absolutely worked for me. And for an audience as well, obviously watching on TV at the time, it must have had the same effect. Although that's what they were used to at that point.
Yeah, I think, to be fair, there was a lot of sort of quick camera cuts in the 90s. There was a lot of things happening very quickly, sort of all over the place. That was just sort of television in general. So hopefully that was kind of reflective of that.
Sounds like Kevin Dunn shooting an average match. one thing I did like after this, and it's something I'm probably going to come back to, is the 95, the intro at that time to Raw, because you had the recap and then the actual intro, I think, unless I've just got my notes in the wrong order. That 95 intro, where it looks like there's an absolute riot happening around a wrestling match, I believe at Titan Towers.
On the
that was fantastic. That sort of the shenanigans from the week before, that intro, that looking back was obviously the sort of first seeds of the Attitude Era. But then, as we'll get into sort of later in the show, a lot of it still felt stuck in that sort of late 80s, early 90s cheese that was rapidly becoming uncool.
Yeah, no, I can't agree more. The open for the show was amazing. And obviously I knew that Raw had that open, but I would have guessed, looking back, it was later than 95. I didn't remember being that early. And it did sort of feel a bit out of step in a good way with the rest of the programme. So that was really enjoyable. And as you say, it does sort of link into the next section, because then we get another video package showing the 1-2-3 kid beating Razor Ramon 2 years previously.
What a great callback. Sorry, I cut you off again, but what a great callback. Two years ago, Kid beat Razor, but we're bringing it back into your memory. It's just another layer to the story.
Yeah, and often in the modern product, they'll say they don't do long-term storytelling. And to be fair, I don't know if they'd necessarily thought out this to be a long-term story, but if you've got that history there anyway, then of course you should use it.
I don't think they thought 20 years ago that Don Callis would be the invisible hand bringing companies together for fear of Kenny Omega and Bullet Club, but they've made it sound like they did, and belief is 90% of a story, isn't it?
Well, that's it, and that goes into the whole promotion of the show, the storyline, which is done. Touched on earlier. And then we get another video flashback, and this is to SummerSlam. It's Razor Ramon attacking Dean Douglas in the classroom after his match at SummerSlam a month ago. So there's plenty of callbacks. Obviously, Razor's going to have the match against Dean Douglas at In Your House 3. And then we get into the match. Lawler on commentary saying the breakup's going to be worse than Sonny and Cher. It's nice to see that WWE's references were horribly out of date, even in 1995.
and Jerry Lawler's not really moved on. That was something I noticed. One thing I noticed with the commentary as well, straight off the bat, was that Lawler started the more animated and Vince was trying to play it straight. They very quickly switched, because I don't think Vince could contain his hyperactivity. And Vince was the one giving he was just a constant motor mouth, just of information. But he was actually dropping in some decent stuff, little backstories, plugging the In Your House show. And I actually quite rated McMahon's commentary on for this one.
It's funny though, because when you've got a commentator who doesn't have Vince McMahon shouting in their ear, they do quite a good job. That must be one of the advantages of being Vince McMahon, that he actually has that vision so he can do it himself. But then he's backstage trying to tell everyone else how to give out his vision, and
it's not going to filter through other people's brain and down a microphone as quickly as it comes out of his gob.
No, exactly. But he can be very animated. And I did think it was interesting in the match that Lawler was trying to really sow those seeds that perhaps the kid might be working with Dean Douglas. I mean, it's sort of classic heel commentator thing, but...
Yeah, it was very typical of Lawler at the time. Just, you know, always siding with the heels. He was Heenan light.
Yeah, Bobby Heenan would have been better. Although, to be fair, you know, if we'd have watched WWF from a few years earlier, it would have been better, so...
Yeah, exactly. When I say Heenan light, that's it's not necessarily a knock on Lawler, but it feels like they were trying to recapture the same Heenan magic that only Heenan can do, but with Jerry Lawler, who... Nobody's ever going to be Bobby Heenan.
No.
Ever. Fair play, they tried to do the same... they tried to have the same formula, because you had Gorilla and Heenan... straight-laced and heel-focused and weaselly. So they tried to do the same, McMahon and Lawler. But McMahon and Lawler don't have that same natural chemistry. And, yeah, it just... While Vince's commentary was good, it's almost unfair to compare him to Gorilla and Heenan.
Yeah, it's never going to be easy trying to replicate those two, which often I've pointed out as people's favourite commentary team of all time, so it's a high standard to try and attain. Just on the production side in this match, did you notice there was a hell of a lot of crowd noise piped in?
Yep, that is one of the first things I've got in my notes. I was looking at the match itself, and it was a... what you call a classic big guy versus little guy match for the most part, and it was fine. It was quite enjoyable, seeing, obviously went on to be a big fan of Scott Hall, Razor Ramon, and 1-2-3 Kid had always had a good match in him, and it would have been a good opening match to a show if it wasn't right at the arse end of a marathon taping session. Yeah, there were a lot of empty spaces on those bleachers for that amount of noise to be happening, but I think this is I'd guess that this is a more recent dubbing.
It could possibly have been. I did find it funny, though, that there was a point in the match where Razor was trying to break out of a sleeper hold, and you could quite clearly see a guy in the audience yawning. So
I didn't pick up on that.
I've never seen it. It's like Damien Mizdow, isn't it? Someone in the crowd's being affected by the sleeper hold.
Yeah. Did you see the goth in the crowd?
No.
They looked like they were decked out in almost like... it was just white face, black eye makeup, black hair, sat there looking like Crow Sting before Crow, years before Crow Sting was a thing. I don't think they moved throughout this whole episode. But now that you're saying it was a 14-match taping, I'm pretty sure they started all bright and bubbly. They started out looking like Surfer Sting and ended up looking like Crow Sting.
It wouldn't have surprised me if they were crash test dummies in this crowd just to beef up the numbers. It was... it was hard watch at that time, and I think a lot of people were just wanting to go to bed, really. So at the end of the match, there's a ref bump. Kid rolls out of the ring. Dean Douglas runs down and attacks Razor. The kid's completely oblivious by the time he gets back in the ring, pins Razor and wins the match.
One thing I will say, within the match itself, and obviously I can't critique anybody's in-ring work because I'm just a fat northern idiot, but the head clash and the ref bump was all done very well, to the point where I was like, did they actually just knock heads and knock that dude over? I was just sat there, I couldn't tell. I watched it 3 or 4 times and I couldn't tell. And there was a really nice sequence where Razor picked Kid up, dumped him on the stomach first on the top rope, booted him, got onto the second rope, picked him up, went for the big fall away slam, and then just chopped the life out of his chest. That was just really impressive.
I mean, it was a much better match than the crowd gave it credit for, really.
But at least the post-production popped for it.
Yeah, Kevin Dunn's there on the button. He really enjoyed it. It just felt like a real shame that, this was a match that clearly had sort of pay-per-view implications. And In Your House 3 is a bit of a strange pay-per-view because you've got all your champions in one match. Mm-hmm. So I guess to a certain extent, you're then sort of putting more emphasis on the lower card matches. But, certainly they were building towards the Dean Douglas Razor match. It had the implications, but the crowd didn't seem to care. And if you can't get the crowd who are in attendance to care about the upcoming pay-per-view match, then you're going to struggle to get people to buy
this. But this is why I put fan reaction dead last. Because I watched every element of this leading up to this point on this show. The way it was presented, the backstory given first, the match itself, the finish. I'm looking at it going, I'm going to look up that match.
Yeah.
26 years later, I've never watched that pay-per-view. I'm going to watch that match because I want to see how it turned out. So it worked for me.
Well, and that's all that matters. You know, wrestling is designed to make people part with the money and, you know, watch the next event.
$9.99 a month.
$9.99 a month. You know, so, you know, it's done its job. So the next segment goes to Dean Douglas in the classroom. They clearly didn't pre-tape this because Dean's out of breath and sweating and rubbing himself down with a towel after running back from the ring to the backstage.
Christ almighty, yeah. This segment.
And he's giving grades for everything. So he gives the kid a D because he's dumb. He gives Razor an E because he's trying to elevate himself by fighting Dean Douglas. Gives his performance that evening an A because he clearly was. And it's a no-brainer that he's going to win at the pay-per-view. So, you know, that spells Dean, and it's just amazing.
I question any person who professes to be educated that doesn't know that E and N are not really generally grades that you give.
Well, I mean, Dean Douglas was a teacher in a former life.
This segment, though, while I enjoyed it, because it's a certain nostalgia aspect, because you'd rarely see anything like that nowadays. This is what I was on about between the sort of disparity in tone between the opening and what goes on in the rest of the show, because that is, it's for all it's a laugh now, that is cheesy as fuck.
Yeah,
it really is. So I was just like, what is this Attitude Era? Is it the 80s? What am I watching? And I do wonder if that sort of changing tone, that up and down tone, is maybe a reason why, as you alluded to earlier, obviously the hit height of, what was the height that they hit?
3.9.
3.9, down to a 2.5. They're heading into a B-level pay-per-view. Does that disparity in tone, you know, is that one of the factors?
The next segment, I've just got The Million Dollar Man got slopped by Henry O. Godwin.
And who doesn't love that?
Yeah, he's brilliant. That's all you kind of needed to know. The reason being is that the Million Dollar Man's going to manage Sid in a match against Henry O. Godwin at In Your House 3, and the Million Dollar Man's managing in the next match. So there's kind of a theme there, but it's great to see someone get slopped. So,
it really is. But again, people, I was going to say chucking slop at people's, one of the cheesy tropes, but it still gets a pop today.
Yeah.
Change slop. The only difference between 95 and 99 was you change slop to blood.
Yeah, and that was great with Gangrel.
This is a tenuous link to the upcoming In Your House, though, with for DiBiase anyway.
Yeah. And so the match is the Million Dollar Corporation, that's the Tanker and Karma, and they're against Salvio Vega and Spark Plug Bob Holly. Always a bit weird to see Bob Holly in his Sparky Plug gimmick rather than his hardcore gimmick.
I don't like Bob Holly with long hair, it freaks me out. It's like seeing Kazarian in TNA when he had the long hair, and it's just like my brain just can't reconcile it.
It is funny with Kazarian though, because I'd sort of seen him first with long hair, so
yeah, same
that way around.
So no, but I'd seen him for years with long hair, then he finally cut it, and I thought, wow, that suits him so much better. And then you go see the old clips now, and you're like, oh, Kaz, mate, what are you doing? This is like when I had that stupid chin strap beard. It just doesn't suit me, and nobody told me.
So when Kazarian was in TNA originally, it was Frankie the Future Kazarian. So at what point in his personal timeline do you think he's at now if he was the future in the mid-noughties?
Frankie the Vet. He's not looking after animals, he's just a veteran.
That could be a gift for him.
Frankie the Vet and his tag team partner, Isaac Yankum, DDS.
Well, Isaac Yankum will be coming up on show shortly.
And I will refuse to say a bad word against him.
Well, you have to watch and see. So it's the match, as we say. King makes a line on commentary that Waylon Mercy, who's going to be facing Salvio Vega at In Your House 3, is going to flatten him like Hurricane Marilyn has flattened the Caribbean, which seems a very ill-thought attempt from WWE to be in touch with what's going on in the world. And the interesting thing about this is that this show was recorded before Hurricane Marilyn happened. So this is something they've put in post-production to make it look like the show's going out live.
It was either that or King took a gamble.
There hadn't been a Hurricane Marilyn when this was recorded. So unless he was
guessing. But was it a case that, because I've been in Florida when a hurricane's due to hit, and for days beforehand, they have the path mapped out.
Well, quite possibly. But I think during this era, they definitely did try and put things in post-production. Maybe this wasn't one, but either way, it seems a bit of a deceptive thing to put in.
It's what Michael Cole would call vintage Jerry Lawler and his bad taste bullshit.
There's a lot of it, and I'm sure we'll have more of that to come.
There really is. And the thing is, like going back to the Heenan thing, when we've been watching the early 90s pay-per-views for that 90s wrestling podcast, a lot of what Heenan says as we've brought up is just so close to the bone or just downright unacceptable now. But for some reason, rightly or wrongly, he gets a pass because he's Heenan.
Yeah, and I suppose to a certain extent, you know, there's stand-up comedians that can get away with saying things that are more close to the bone than other people can because they're funny, and, you know, maybe that's not fair. It kind of, it's almost how people react to it. I think the problem with this is that this is something that feels like it's not just off-the-cup Jerry Lawler remark. This feels like it's something that the company's thought is a good idea to go out on the product.
Yeah, they've decided. It's another one of those where we've got a match with Savio Vega and Tatanka. Tatanka's not long dropped the whole headdress thing. Then you've got Bob Holly, who's just, you know, fresh out of his racing overalls, which is, you know, it's all very early late 80s, early 90s stuff. But let's be edgy and drop in a Hurricane reference.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. So looking around at the seats for this match, is this a piss break?
Yeah, nobody gave a single fuck on that. Nobody cared. Everybody just went for a slash, which is kind of a shame because it was an all right match. It was four lads. It was just three massive lads and one big bloke. And it was, some of it was good, was top, what I'd call top-notch beef slamming. But again, you've just chucked in a group of people saying a couple of these are going to be on the show at the weekend. They're not fighting each other. You know, it's not like a G1 show where they're in a tag team match and then they're going to face each other the next night. There was not a lot of reason to give a toss about this match, even watching from home.
Yeah, I quite like Karma's reverse high cross body from the top rope at the end of the match.
What's that move called? I believe it's called the fuck your neck. Yeah, years later, that'd get Bob Holly a title shot.
Yeah, should have still been in his Sparky Plug costume. But yeah, the crowd didn't even bother staying around for the match. Very little reaction for the hot tag. A couple of, some good bits, but kind of just an average match that no one really cared about.
There was more piped in chants as well. But at the end of this match, and I can't remember why he did it, King dropped in a reference to Jeffrey Dahmer, saying that Dahmer's mum had kept his brain to eat it.
Wow.
He went on this, it wasn't even just one line. It was a few sentences about Jeffrey Dahmer's execution and how his mum kept his brain because his mum wanted to eat it because the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And shit, like, I'm just like, how did that get through? And the only reason it's not, from studying media law 10 years ago, the only reason it wasn't any form of slander or libel or defamation, whatever, is because he used the phrase, "I heard," at the start of the sentence.
Wow.
So it's counted as hearsay and therefore is exempt from that sort of rule. And if you get a chance, go back and listen to it. Because I sat there and I paused it. I said, what the fuck did he just say? And I rewound it. And I wish now I'd written it out word for word, but I didn't want to give it that much credence.
It is bizarre, the sort of references that they put in. There was one thing he said, and I tried to Google it. I couldn't find out what it was, but there's one thing I think he said that the toilet was broken on the International Space Station or something.
Yeah, something about the Endeavour crew, yeah.
Yeah, I was the Endeavour, right? I was probably looking up the wrong thing, but yeah, and comparing that to Henry O'Godwin's slot bucket. But yeah, just these weird references that feel like they've got no place.
He's talking about the breakups as well, like Sonny and Cher, and he dropped a... Connie Chung and Dan Rather, I think it was, the news anchors. Yeah. Dropped a reference to them, which thankfully is more timely because I'm pretty sure, well, Dan Rather's still going today, and Connie Chung was one of the biggest names in news in the late 90s, I believe. So at least that was somewhat timely. But again, just weird. You know, say there's, you know, there's kids or young adults watching that and they're going, oh, I don't know who Sonny and Cher are, I don't care. I don't give a shit about the news. And now you're talking about, you know, space travel, fair enough, that's still kind of cool. But now you're talking about a serial killer's mum eating his brain.
Yeah, they're very weird. Although maybe it was just to distract from what was happening in the ring.
The thing is, what happened in the ring wasn't bad, though. It was fine. It was just there. it was inoffensive. I watched the match. It was all right. I looked at my phone a few times. But I wasn't, you know, it wasn't like I was watching it going, oh, when's it going to end? Which I'm sure probably the live crowd were, but...
Yeah, I can imagine they were. They probably still feel like they're there, to be honest. So the next segment is a Razor Ramon promo, obviously talking about his upcoming match with Dean Douglas, saying, forget about your Ivy League education, Razor Ramon's going to carve you up. But, I mean, to be fair, Dean Douglas got a lot out of that Ivy League education. He can spell his own name now, so it obviously paid off.
Yeah, it was... The Razor interview was... the promo was... surprisingly muted for the time, because at that point I think there were still a lot of what we've sort of dubbed shouty 80s cocaine promos. So, but seeing Razor take the Jake Roberts tack of speaking softly, and so softly at one point that I actually had to turn my TV up just to hear what he was saying, because the sound mixing on the edit's so bad. But yeah, again, it was decent. It was above average, I'd say, as far as a you know, 2-minute promo goes, or whatever it was.
Yeah, it was all right. It was all right. The next section is an advert for a showing on Fox later in the month of WrestleMania 11.
And we're back with the edgy stuff and the cool-looking stuff for 1995. The advert for WrestleMania 11, you've got Shawn Michaels and Diesel looking just cool as shit. They've got there's Pamela Anderson there. There's
Salt and Pepper.
It's Salt and Pepper. It's very flashily cut. It makes you want to watch it, and that's more in the keeping with the intro to the show than the match that preceded it. It's this very up and down tone.
It's probably perfect for the network, because I'm sure there were some people at this point, if they were watching this episode of Raw, that might have been persuaded to go watch WrestleMania 11 instead. So
it's not like you had an on demand service. It's not like you could just get it willy nilly on a video. They were probably, by September, they were probably still waiting for videos of WrestleMania to hit shelves.
Oh yeah, they would be. It did take a long time for the VHSs to come out.
So as far as TV goes and getting ratings for a different program, that'd have worked wonders. Imagine seeing that in the 90s. I'd have been all over that. WrestleMania 11. Yes, I'm sitting down to watch that.
Yeah, and there wasn't as much wrestling on. You know, you didn't have things like Fight or whatever, so there'd have been more of a demand to watch that again so soon. So the next match is Jean-Pierre Lafitte, who's now wrestling as PCO, and he's against Brian Walsh. And during this match, there's promo for the upcoming match with Bret Hart. It's showing video packages of Lafitte stealing Bret Hart's sunglasses that he's just given to a fan. And taking Bret Hart's jacket while Bret Hart's having a match with Rad Radford.
I'll be honest. With this match, it took me far longer than I care to admit to realise that Jean-Pierre Lafitte is PCO. I even listened. This was like, I'm going to tell this story because I know she always gets a kick of it. You know, Mackenzie, friend of mine, Mackenzie. We were sat there watching the early 2000s Dracula, the one with Gary Oldman playing Dracula. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he's got like big, you know, perm, fluffy hair, sunglasses on most of the time, and it literally took me till 10 minutes before the end of the film for me to sit there and just go, is that Gary fucking Oldman? Well, I've not read anything about the movie. I just went in completely blind, and that this was what I call my Gary Oldman moment of this wrestling show, where an hour after watching the show, I just went, fucking PCO. looking like a fucking Mad Max pirate.
With a Bret Hart jacket for no reason.
I love those Bret Hart jackets.
But you didn't really see much of him, because obviously there was the flashback to the events with Bret Hart, and it didn't look like that bad a match between Brian Walsh seemed to get a bit of offense in and then was selling like a trooper. But for most of the match, there was actually a call where Vince called Bret Hart on the set of Lonesome Dove to talk about the upcoming match. And
it was so distracting.
Well, Bret sounded so bored. It's like he couldn't give a shit about the upcoming match.
I don't think he could.
He was probably there thinking, I'm being treated like a serious actor and I've got to go back to that crap. You know,
he only made me spit beer. Yeah, you're exactly right. But it's one of those things where you just wouldn't see that nowadays. And judging by this version of it, for good reason, Bret sounded bored. It completely distracted me from the match. The bits of the match I could sort of force myself to focus on because of this droning in the background were fine. They were good. You know, it was all right. But through no fault of their own, either Jean-Pierre Lafitte or Brian Walsh, I just couldn't. My mind was wandering because Brett's droning, Lawler's throwing. That call actually did more for Brett versus Lawler than Brett versus Jean-Pierre Lafitte. I'm sat there with my mind wandering, thinking, doesn't that guy in the third row on the aisle seat look like Aiden English?
Well, he's on the job for life, but he didn't know that involved going back in time to pad out the mid-90s crowds.
I'd take that job.
Yeah. Well, it depends what the hours are.
14 matches.
Yeah. So obviously, Jean-Pierre Lafitte goes on to win. Yeah, we didn't really get a fair crack at seeing this match, but it was what it was.
This was the piss break for the other half of the crowd that didn't use the tag match as a piss break. One thing I'll give it, though, that flipping senton from Jean-Pierre Lafitte, love it.
Yeah, he's always he was sort of ahead of his time then. You know, that was seen as being pretty spectacular at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I popped. Again, 26 years later, I popped. Oh, next bit, sorry, I'm going to steal this from you. Tony Chimmel was reinforcing the ring, which apparently means just tightening the turnbuckles a little bit.
Well, you're going to have to if you're going to get two big behemoths in there like Yokozuna and Mabel. While they're doing that, there's a promo package for In Your House 4 showing the build-up for Diesel as the WWF champion and Shawn Michaels the Intercontinental champion versus the tag team champions of Yokozuna and Owen Hart, and all the belts are on the line. And then possibly the most exciting bit of the show for you, Dan, it's a palanquin being carried out with Mabel on the front. And is the guy who's struggling with the palanquin the mullet guy from the Macho Man's palanquin at WrestleMania 7?
I was unable to verify because I was never able to find the identity of the bloke with the spectacular mullet who was on the, as you looked at it on camera, on front left of Macho Man's palanquin. For comedy's sake, I'm going to say it was. And he has literally been part of WWE for, by that point, at least 4 years, just so he can carry a variety of people to the ring. But going back to that that promo for In Your House, I've been banging on to the point where people are probably bored now of me saying disparity in tone. This advert is a microcosm of that. It managed to be kind of cool and pretty cheesy all at the same time. And I don't know where that would have fallen in 1995, because on one hand, HBK and Diesel stood there. They look cool as shit, but then you call them two dudes with attitudes.
That name really annoyed me, especially Vince McMahon's thing.
Fuck off. Yeah, well this is, Vince saying that particular phrase reminded me of John Cena as Lance Catamaran in Southpaw Regional Wrestling. As much as I enjoyed Vince's commentary throughout this show, that specific thing, I'm just thinking, who let that go? Who acquiesced and said that was a good team name?
But this goes back to your point at the start of saying that everyone else had a Vince McMahon asterisk next to him. This is a time when Vince isn't taking any direction from anybody else. Mm. He doesn't have, you know, Bill Watts or Bruce Pritchard arguing with him. He's just doing what he wants, and he thinks standing in the ring and screaming two dudes with attitude is what's going to get him numbers.
It's biting me in the ass already. Yeah, it's just that one specific thing. I'm just like, oh, for God's sake. Also, I took in my notes, just for sort of brevity's sake, I took to calling Yokozuna and Owen Hart Yokoin.
Are you shipping them?
No, I'm just too lazy to keep saying Yokozuna and Owen Hart.
Just gone down to Yoko in mine, but
Yokoin. the match itself wasn't that bad. There was, in fairness, you know, saying they're reinforcing the ring, there was some tonnage. But the other thing that caught my eye in this match was having Fuji and Cornette in Owen and Brett's corner, in Yoko's corner. It was a bit of egging the pudding a little bit, wasn't it, in terms of the managers?
It's quite funny because there wasn't sort of managers for, apart from DiBiase, there wasn't really managers for anyone else on the card. And then these two have two, so they're like hogging all
the... DiBiase did nothing.
Well, he got slopped. He was probably still in shock from his slopping the week before. You missed something really important, though, Dan. This match was sponsored by milk. Not a particular brand of milk, just milk.
Was it?
Yes.
How the fuck did I miss that?
It's like those old adverts from the 1960s where Bobby Moore's advertising, go to the pub. Not a specific pub, just the pub.
Go out and get pissed, you bastards.
I mean, this was literally, drink milk.
That's a real trade down from Hogan's say your prayers and take your vitamins line, isn't it?
Well, you know, maybe they'd run out of Icapro or whatever, or it'd find, you know, a medical condition. So they're just hedging the bets, you know.
Oh, crap. No, I missed that. I missed that completely. Can we credit the WWE with laying the seed for the Got Milk advert?
Well, I think it was Got Milk, in all fairness. But, yeah, so it's like, there was the Milk Cup, wasn't there? The familiar name for the League Cup. So there's a proud tradition of milk sponsoring things.
That's two really weird links, because I could have sworn the Got Milk advert was much later than 95. But for Vince McMahon gave us two things, the Got Milk advert and the Milk Cup. Did we really just spend all that talking about a match sponsorship?
I just find it bizarre, you know. And it's funny because, you know, you listen to things like 83 Weeks or whatever, and Bischoff's there talking about, you know, what sort of sponsorships you can get, and the WWE being really savvy and sort of moving into the more valuable sponsorships. I mean, is Milk a valuable sponsorship? Is it some kind of Milk millionaire event? So.
They've got deals nowadays with whoever the fuck they've got deals with, I don't know. And then 1995, Milk.
Well, you hear about Money Marks. Is there some kind of Milk Mark that's sponsoring them?
Well, Vince McMahon's been milking talent for extra money for years, hasn't he?
He has. Maybe there's some subliminal message in there. But this was one match where the crowd actually seemed into it for a bit, especially when you got Yoko and Mabel in the ring at the same time.
Yes, it's sort of the first noticeable sort of major pop in this whole Raw. There was a bit of crowd sort of stirring during the 1-2-3 Kid Razor Ramon match. You know, there was a little bit in there, but this you could see it. You know, I started piped in crowd noise aside, you could see people were really going for it. And I looked into it. This was Yoko and Owen were 172 days into their reign as champions, so they've been around for a long time. They've had the titles for a while. Obviously, Mabel's not long won the King of the Ring. That sort of longevity and the King of the Ring still being a prestigious tournament would go a ways to explain it, because that was the first sort of, this one, like, these guys are stars. Yoko's a former two-time champion at this point. Mabel's earmarked as one for the future. Owen Hart, by a lot of people's reckoning, should have been a champion already. So it made a lot of sense why they were into that.
Yeah, that made a lot of sense. But the match in general, you've got two heel teams against each other. And part of the problem is that the crowd seem to have chosen Yoko and Owen as the de facto faces in the match.
I think that goes though, because Owen's the smallest guy in the match, so he's taking all the offense from Men on a Mission. So that, you know, seeing a small guy get beat down, I'm always going to root for the underdog. So, you know, for Owen to then, it seems like they're going to build up to a hot tag to Yoko. I can understand why they'd get behind him. And it also, is it a case of, you know, at the weekend, they're defending the titles against HBK and Diesel. Do they just hate HBK and Diesel more than they hate Yoko and Owen?
Oh, quite possibly. But it did seem a little bit weird that you were trying to, you know, at the last minute, you sort of put some sympathy on the heels that are going into your main event match of the pay-per-view.
I'm not entirely sure it was intentional.
It probably wasn't at this point. Even the booking committee wanted to go home. So, who knows?
And credit to him, Vince's energy was still up.
Oh, yes.
It's still going for it at this point. But, you know, that's sort of quite typical from what you've seen throughout his run. Whatever he's done on TV has always been very high energy, and not like the Owen Hart tag team he was in.
So overall, I mean, Owen obviously did a lot of lifting in this match. The other three were quite limited physically. Although, you know, there was always sort of a quick turn of pace from Yoko or whatever, but certainly not able to do too much in the match. And at least the crowd were invested, so.
Yeah, it was fine. I mean, there were a couple of bits that, one of the nitpicky things I had was when Owen Hart shoved Mo into the steps, Mabel went out to check on him and then just chucked him back in the ring to get fucked up by Yokozuna. But this match, to give you an idea of it, of sort of the popularity thing, this was the first time I saw anybody in the crowd with a sign at ringside, and it was for Yokozuna and Owen Hart. So that kid that had made that sign or brought it with him had thought ahead of time. So was this part of a natural face turn for Yoko and Owen? That was the other question that was in my mind. I've just seen it in my notes. And another thing I noticed as well, I believe this was the first multi-segment match of the show where they went to a break mid-match. I don't recall there being a break in the opening match.
No, I mean, it is a little bit hard to tell on the network, isn't it?
Vince actively said, we'll be back after this, which indicated an ad break, and then they've come back. And that brought me back to NWA Power, because that's my most recent sort of experience of a show of that length. They very rarely had matches that went beyond 10 minutes. If it went over 15 minutes, you knew something was going down. And I'm wondering if it's the same sort of logic. One last thing that I really, really like was Mabel clotheslined Yokozuna, and the cameraman, I don't know if you spotted it, the cameraman shook the camera up and down to simulate the impact. A bit like they do on NXT UK nowadays with Dave Mastiff during his entrance. except this makes slightly more sense. And I thought it was fantastic. You know, like you got about 1,100 pounds just hitting the ring, and the camera wobbling. And the camera was like, "Oh, that I like that. That's a really nice little touch."
That was good. That was good. It's nice about paying attention.
Yeah. Sometimes. Hey, I think it was nice. I was paying attention by this point.
No, but you know, sometimes the cameramen. It's a little bit difficult. Different in WWE because they've got their own camera people, but other promotions, the camera people are just sort of generic cameramen, so they don't sort of catch little bits like that.
Yeah, they're there to find an angle, not to shoot the action, as it were.
Yeah, totally. So the next segment was a Diesel and Sean promo. Do you have anything from this one?
It was fine. It was a typical promo. Sean's bit was obviously a lot better. It was the typical arrogant bastard Shawn Michaels of the era. You know, the first thing he did was make a big nose Owen Hart joke, which I think they still ran with 2 years later when Jason Sensation came in doing the impressions and when he was on commentary. But it did its job. Sean was good. Diesel was just, I know his nickname's Big Daddy Cool, but he was just far too chill. Sean, at least you could detect a bit of, you know, a bit of dislike or, you know, ruthless ambition or something like that. Diesel was like, fuck it, I'm massive.
Yeah.
Don't know what you thought about it, but it was, it did the job.
After a generic promo, he was just kind of there for me.
I mean, at this point, Diesel's 10 months into his reign, which I think is regarded generally as forgettable, even though he held it for nearly a year. Sort of the length of the reign is the only bit that stands out.
It's a really weird one, isn't it? Because he's there as this sort of forgettable champion. But the thing that then is surprising is that when he turns up in WCW, it's completely different and he's seen as a big star and it sort of changes the industry. And it's gone from this guy who was maybe a little bit bland in WWF.
Yeah, but instead he's gone back to WCW and said, "Hey, do you remember Oz? Yeah, he's better than that."
Yeah. So it's the value add rather than what you did.
And, you know, again, going into it, Shawn Michaels is 2 months into his third IC title reign at this point as well. So it's just kind of like they're the known quantities. Shawn Michaels has been around long enough as a heel for people to hate him. Diesel's been champion for 10 months, so people either hate him because he's a heel or they're just sick of him. Is that why, leading up to this, that there was a bit of a face turn going on for Yoko and Owen? Because people... As now, that's what happens now. As soon as they think people are getting forced down the throat, they want a change. It's just back then, it happened over a period of a year, not 35 minutes.
Yeah. No, it's a good point.
The next bit was odd. Sorry, I'll let you run it down. I've just read my notes and thought, yeah, this was weird.
I've maybe got a little bit of a different opinion to this one then. I mean, the start is weird because you've got Vince McMahon in the ring and his fake tan makes him look like he's secretly working in a chocolate factory.
I noticed that. I thought he looked like Donald Trump with jaundice.
Half expected him to sort of jump into a song about overindulgence. Is there interviewing Jim Cornette, there's Yoko Zuna, Owen Hart and Mr. Fuji in the ring. And obviously Kevin Dunn is hitting the crowd button whenever Vince says anything. Start talking about the match and Cornette thinks obviously that Yoko and Owen are going to win. Vince sort of takes real umbrage at that because how can anyone beat two dudes with attitude? And Kevin Dunn's getting RSI from hitting that crowd noise button. But the thing I liked about this, and kind of like you said about the Razor 1-2-3 kid match, Jim Cornette really sold sort of how historic this match was going to be with all the championships on the line.
Oh, I really did.
I thought it was a really decent promo. And given that this wasn't a great show and, you know, he really made me want to watch that match at the pay-per-view. So to me, that kind of really did its job.
Yeah, it did. And when I say this bit was weird, it's purely because this is, to me, and again, probably recency bias, is a very odd way to end a show. I know that I get the purpose behind it. I know that then Cornette's a divisive figure in wrestling nowadays. What a promo. He's just, you can't deny his talent. A phenomenal promo. Especially back then when he was at, quote, sort of roughly the height of his power, you know, and the height of his talent. Sold it to me. Like I said, I want to watch that pay-per-view. Based on watching this show, I want to watch that pay-per-view. So it's done its job. Some segments more than others. So yeah, it worked absolutely fine. I just, ending the show with a promo and then just the camera on Vince and King and going for King's Royal Prediction. That sort of very end bit was, because I got like, okay, this is hyping me up. Weird way to end a show with a promo, but I get what they're doing. And then to go into that Royal Prediction, I'm just kind of like, oh, and that's come dangerous with close to losing me.
Do you know what I think that Jerry Lawler prediction was, though? I don't know if you remember, but at the end of Jerry Springer, after there'd been sort of all this sort of fighting between the guests and the crowd and all this sort of thing, there was this sort of calm moment at the end where they went to Jerry Springer and they went for his final thoughts, and, you know, he'd say something sensible that was completely out of tone with the craziness that had gone on before. And I kind of wonder if they were trying to hop on the back of that. Obviously, you know, Springer was doing crazy in the mid-90s.
It'd be very timely to do that. Because even as a kid, because I think when this aired, I'd have been 6 years old. And even then, I knew of the whole Jerry Springer thing and the Jerry jokes that, you know, that just seeped into other media. I think by that point, they were popping up in cartoons.
Yeah.
That we were getting over here. So viewed from that, I hadn't even considered that, because as you, by this point, I was kind of like, do I really have to think about this anymore? I'd have preferred it just to end with the promo, because that was the point where I was like, I'm locked in.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. And I do think that over the next couple of years, that both WCW and WWF start taking a lot more from the shows that are popular at the time. You know, and, you know, like I say, things like Springer, like confrontational things like, as daft as it sounds, things like Judge Judy, and things over, you know, this side of the Atlantic with like The Word and Eurotrash, sort of really irrelevant sort of programming or whatever, that wrestling sort of hit that zeitgeist.
Sorry, just to butt in again, I'm not meaning to call you out. I assume you mean irreverent, not irrelevant.
Yeah, I did mean irreverent.
Yeah, sorry, I just wanted to catch that because
being fact checked again.
I'm not trying to be a bastard for once. But no, yeah, you are right. Yeah, I'm not trying, it comes naturally to me. But you are right with the celebrity involvement. I mean, wrestling's always had, or at least since WrestleMania's all and Rock and Wrestling Connection, all that, has always had some form of celebrity involvement. But throughout the 90s, as wrestling hit its peak in the mainstream, that, you know, the example that always springs to my mind, Mike Tyson. He's riding the height of his notoriety following biting Evander Holyfield in 98. He bit Evander Holyfield obviously before that, but he's right, he's still regarded the baddest man on the planet, the hottest commodity in boxing, household name globally. WWE's at the height of its popularity, from what I remember. I'm sure you can come up with some ratings that prove me wrong. WWE's in its most mainstream era, shall we say, and it was a perfect storm. So I've completely forgotten the point I was going to make. This beer is very nice. Oh, I just completely went off on a tangent there, sorry.
No, it's fine. We were just talking about how the Jerry Lawler segment
yes, that's it, yeah. Bring it full circle. So, yeah, it could have been the start of it, or at least sort of alluding to it.
But that wasn't quite the end of the show, because they decided to air a promo for what was happening next week on Raw. And I'm all for promoting next week's show, but kind of the problem is you've got a pay-per-view in between. So they were promoting a match between the Bulldog and the Undertaker, which, you know, great thing to promote, great idea.
I forgot to note this down.
Bulldog's got a match against Bam Bam Bigelow at the pay-per-view. The only time we've mentioned Bam Bam Bigelow is on the advert for WrestleMania 11. Given that you're trying to sell that show, surely it's, you know, kicking a ball into an open net to promote the Bulldog-Bam Bam match at the pay-per-view.
Yeah, you'd have thought so. It could have been Bulldog and Bam Bam could have been on opposing sides in the tag match, for instance. You could have taken Cameron Tatanka out of there, and I think, you know, Savio has a match at In Your House, so you could have stayed in. Bob Holly, as far as I know, doesn't have a match at In Your House, or even then, have Bam Bam and Bulldog try and get along in the match, have them try and be tag partners, something daft like that. It'd make more sense than having just Cameron Tatanka just sat there. Just say, look, DiBiase, he got slopped. His other charge has got a match at the pay-per-view. But we're not going to put Sid in.
But they need to do that. I mean, that would be the ideal scenario if they'd had some involvement. But even if they didn't, they could have just tied in the advertising. you know, it would have been very easy to create that video package a different way, or to just, you know, have King and McMahon mention it, but they went another way. So in terms of the show overall, what did you think?
Well, I alluded to this at the start of the show when we were talking about the beer. It was fine. It was slightly above average. It did its job in terms of making me want to watch In Your House, which I am going to do at some point. I'm getting to it 26 years late, which is quite early for me, being eternally behind the times. I know we were going to look at giving a numerical sort of rating out of 10, but in honour of Dean Douglas, I've given each of our five categories a letter grade and then a final overall grade. So the matches I gave a C. They were fine. There was nothing terrible. The only match that didn't hold my attention well, it wasn't their fault. So the matches have got a C. The promos have got a C. Again, they were fine. They did the job. It was, you know, it was average. It was a passing grade. Production aspects, I actually gave a B+. Commentary kept it tight. The intros and everything were really decent. Dean Douglas, for all it was cheesy, was entertaining in hindsight. Like I said, the recaps kept everything tight, kept it moving. It was very well paced for the most part. So that's got a B+. For the storyline aspects, a B. Again, kept everything ticking along, made me want to watch the show. A fair amount of it was relevant to the In Your House pay-per-view, which a go-home show needs to be. And for the fan response, I gave it a D, because bar the main event and a couple of bits at the beginning, there was virtually nothing, and that was the only thing that stopped it getting an F. So overall, I gave it, with it all being fair, with two Cs, a B plus a B and a D, I gave it a C+, which would be about a 6 out of 10.
Well, just to put that in context, the community vote on Cage Match has given it an average of 5.31. So you're sort of going high, people that have rated it so far.
I am generally quite generous.
I'm generally quite pessimistic. To be fair, I think that 5.31's a little bit optimistic for the show. I'm going to grade it in whole numbers, maybe further down the line. We'll get into points or whatever. But I'd probably give it a 4. I'd probably say it was a little bit below average. While I did want to watch the pay-per-view, I think there were things that they missed that were quite easy. The crowd really did take it out for me for that experience. So
which is odd, because we both had the fan response really far down our list. I know obviously none of those elements are unimportant, and any one of them can have an effect. But it does surprise me slightly that the fan aspect took that much away for you.
And maybe I should rate that higher, because when I go to the football, I really rate the fan experience as part of
it. Well, the thing is, I was going to say as well, when we were running through those five elements, it will be nice to revisit this further down the line and see, you know, if and when fans are allowed back into arenas and that's more of what we're consuming on a regular basis. See if that changes our outlook and see how it changes how we feel after. You know, say we have fans back for 6 months, you know, or 3 months, whatever, and we're more used to it. See if that affects our opinions on our own sort of ranking system.
And there's going to be abnormalities as well. You always get the British crowds being, you know, a lot hotter than many of the American crowds, but they're not over here that often. So if they were touring 5-6 times a year like they do for some American cities, then perhaps those reactions wouldn't be as much. So when we do start getting crowds back, we might get a lot better reactions than we've had previously. But then that might normalise again.
Yeah, we'll see. It'll be intriguing.
So now is the award section of the show. Who would you give the MVP of the show?
I was torn on this one because I had two in mind. One was Vince, for keeping the energy up and for the job he did on commentary throughout the show. And the other was Owen Hart, because without Owen Hart, that main event and the longest match of the night and the most important match of the night heading into the pay-per-view, without him or somebody like him, that match bombs for me. So I'm going to be completely arbitrary. And because I've recently given an MVP of a show to a commentator on one of our 90s wrestling podcast reviews, I'm going to give it to Owen Hart.
That's completely in line with my thinking. I mean, I'd put it sort of the other way around and put Owen Hart for the exact same reasons that you've said. And I'd put an honorary mention in there for Jim Cornette. This is no reflection on his current personality or what he says, but he did a really good job in that promo. Really sold it. Really sold the importance of it. Something that's probably very close to his heart, so he found easy to do, but really made you want to watch the pay-per-view. So I was impressed with that. But no, I'll go with Owen for the same reasons that you've said. So the next one is the match of the night.
Match of the night for me, easy, no contest. Razor Ramon, 1-2-3, kid. Absolutely. Yeah. There is no contest.
It's funny because you look at it and you think, could I give it to anything else? And you just can't. There's just not that much. I mean, potentially you'd be then looking at maybe the squash match with PCO versus Brian Walsh.
Well, this is the thing. The actual, when I say best match, I mean, the one, I give it to the one that I enjoyed most from an in-ring point of view.
Yeah.
And that is far and away the best match in the ring. But you can give, you know, you can, the first tag match was solid. It was fine. There was nothing wrong with it. The squash match, it's a squash match. It did its job. If anything, for a squash match, it went a little bit long, but they had to deal with Bret Hart's droning phone call.
Yeah.
I couldn't give it to that because of the phone call, it just didn't hold my attention. The main event had the most sort of storyline investment, or at least joint with the opening match. But I like a hoss match as much as anybody else. I like two big guys knocking the fuck out of each other. I don't like two guys who are built like me waving their arm fat at each other. You know what I mean?
It's one of those things that looks a lot better on paper than in reality. And, you know, the crowd are very excited to see it, but it was never going to live up to anything.
No. A good match doesn't have to be a great wrestling match. Like the hype around Hogan Andre and the fact that people still talk about that body slam.
Yeah.
All these years later, it was not a good match.
No.
But it was the culmination of a great story, and that makes it a great match.
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose the analogy for Yoko and Mabel is Big Daddy and Giant Haystacks. Two people that are incredibly limited, but, you know, they've got that sort of charisma or whatever, and the crowd really wants to see that, and they'd much rather see them do very little than some people who are more able do a lot more. But there you go. So, the next one, Mullet of the Night.
Mullet of the Night. Dear me. I was so tempted to give it to the guy carrying the palanquin again. So tempted, just because I think it's the same bloke who's just been training all these years just to lift, you know, lifting weights, just to be told, like, right, you carried Savage really well to that at WrestleMania 7. Now is your biggest challenge. But I can't do it. The best mullet on that show is Razor Ramon. I've got to give Mullet of the Night to the bad guy. It just has to be done. That thing is glorious with a little curl that drops down the front of his forehead. Come on, even I'd want that haircut now if it wouldn't make me look absolutely ridiculous.
It's difficult at this point in time because a lot of people sort of growing out the mullets and just have long hair. So like Kevin Nash just has long hair rather than a mullet per se. But my Mullet of the Night's actually going to the same match. I'm going to give it to the 1-2-3 kid. Because, you know, he is business at the front, party at the back sort of thing in the true spirit of the mullet.
The problem is now you've mentioned 1-2-3 kid in the phrase party at the back. And all I'm remembering now is that two things from X-Pac. When he came back and he cut that promo as part of DX to say he's here to rip ass. And the fact that he bust his arsehole on a Bronco Buster.
We'll be talking about Nia Jax at this rate.
No, we won't. Because that was just too fucking funny. Oh, my hole. I've not even watched Raw, but I've seen that.
It's funny because Raw didn't do well. We talk about ratings, and it's viewing figures rather than ratings for Raw, but they didn't do very well. It's falling once again. But they probably had so many social media and YouTube and whatever viewers just of Nia Jax.
I was going to say it's all consumed very differently nowadays, and I know people who don't watch Raw or SmackDown, but they'll happily cherry pick the YouTube videos to watch or the matches to watch, or even are a month behind, you know, because they're catching it all on the network.
Yeah, well,
which must be a bastard come pay per view time, but
we're currently 25 years behind, so it's all good.
Hey, that's close to the bone for me. That's close to the mark.
So, Dan, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at DanGriffin21. Most of my wrestling tweets, I do watch some sort of contemporary stuff, but generally I'm 6 weeks behind the times. You can also find me on a podcast with my very gracious host, Rob, That 90s Wrestling Podcast. Every month we do the pay-per-view reviews.
We do indeed. You can find me at UTT Rob. Again, most of my content is wrestling related. There may be occasional grumbles about how well Huddersfield Town are playing, but it's mostly wrestling. You can find the podcast at UTT Podcast. And if you want to follow me on Tap, that's UTT Rob again. So thank you very much. And if you have any feedback, we'd love to hear it. You know,